From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now and a big week in presidential politics. Hillary Clinton met with Senator Elizabeth Warren this morning after the Massachusetts senator endorsed Clinton last night on MSNBC.
I am ready to get in this fight and work my heart out for Hillary Clinton to become the next president of the United States and to make sure that Donald Trump never gets any place close to the White House.
And earlier in the day, as we know, President Obama endorsed Clinton after meeting her rival Bernie Sanders at the White House. And Donald Trump this week still facing heat from his own party over comments about a Mexican-American judge. He shifted his tone and used a teleprompter in his speech the other night.
I'm truly honored by your support. Together, we accomplished what nobody thought was absolutely possible. And you know what that is? We're only getting started, and it's going to be beautiful. Remember that.
But otherwise, it feels as if gloves littered the ground at the end of this week. They are off, except we picture our jinglers wearing little white ones. Hit it.
Here and now.
2016.
Rebecca Sinderbrand is politics news editor for The Washington Post. She joins us. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello. Good morning.
And we also welcome Greg Moore, former editor of The Denver Post. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
And I just Rebecca, you start. Does it feel as if there was kind of a shift this week? Boy, Elizabeth Warren, we'll hear more, but attacking Donald Trump, President Obama saying, this is it, I'm making my endorsement, feels like there was a shift.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the interesting thing right now, you look at both parties, it feels as though the Democrats are moving in one direction. We're starting to see the first moves towards party unity. And Republicans seem to be devolving just a bit. We're seeing the relitigation of conversations that we thought were over weeks ago, whether or not they go anywhere. Talk about some sort of moves at the convention, people unendorsing Donald Trump, which began to happen this week. These are things that, you know, they've had 5 weeks now to work past it, and they're still in the conversation.
It's amazing. We're talking about people unendorsing Donald Trump. You're talking about Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois. But on the Democratic side, as we mentioned, Senator Elizabeth Warren jumping in full attack mode yesterday. Here she is in a speech to the American Constitution Society last night, shaming Trump for his attack on the judge.
Trump is picking on someone who is ethically bound not to defend himself. Exactly what you would expect from a thin-skinned racist bully.
She then went on MSNBC to make her endorsement of Hillary Clinton. And the host, Rachel Maddow, asked Warren about the possibility of being Clinton's vice president. Listen to this.
Do you believe you would be capable of stepping into that job and doing that job if you were ever called to do it? Because, and I ask you because Ed Rendell, former DNC chairman, former Pennsylvania governor, said recently that you were in not in any way, shape, or form ready to be commander in chief. I want to know if you think you could be.
Yes, I did.
That was her entire answer to that question. Greg, Warren a really likely person to be the VP for Clinton, or what do you think of all of that?
Well, I mean, I think that she's smart and she's as qualified as, you know, anybody else, I think, as a sitting senator. But that ticket just does not seem really appealing. I also think it would be dangerous.
Why? Explain.
Well, I just think the idea of having two women on the ticket is probably just a bit of a reach. And I think Hillary understands that. What Hillary really needs from Elizabeth Warren is to be the attack dog representing the far left. And I think she's perfectly suited for it. And I think she's going to be very effective.
Well, you know, when Rebecca, jump in, but when Rachel did ask her last night if she wanted to be, she did what she has always said. She said, no, I'm really so honored to represent the people of Massachusetts. And there is a ring of honesty in that. She cannot do as vice president what she does as a senator.
Yeah, and she also said that there was no betting going on. There were no actual moves as yet. Look, whether or not she's going to be on the VP shortlist, the fact is it's very good for Hillary Clinton if people believe that she is for several reasons. One of them is, of course, you know, as Greg just pointed out, the role of attack dog. Elizabeth Warren clearly relishes tangling with Donald Trump, and he doesn't seem to have quite found his footing with how to push back at her. Even now when he's, you know, the nicknames he's come up for her, they're not really landing well. He seems a little bit off kilter.
Pocahontas,
Goofy. They're not quite landing. He seems a little off kilter. And then on the other side, you know, as the party begins the process of coming together, Elizabeth Warren is someone who very much resonates with fans of Bernie Sanders, supporters of Bernie Sanders. She's someone who has made income inequality, the Vermont senator's signature issue, central to her career as well.
Go ahead.
Well, that's the question, I guess, that I was going to ask about Bernie Sanders and his supporters and what happens next. Let's listen to him speaking after his meeting with the president yesterday.
I spoke briefly to Secretary Clinton on Tuesday night, and I congratulated her on her very strong campaign. I look forward to meeting with her in the near future to see how we can work together to defeat Donald Trump and to create a government which represents all of us and not just the 1%.
But then, Greg, when he spoke last night in Washington, it did sound – he said something like, when I'm in the White House, I'm going to do this. His campaign doesn't seem like it's coming to a close. Do you think his supporters are ready to get behind Hillary Clinton?
You know, I don't think they're ready right now, but I think he will get them there. He's posturing. He still wants to be taken seriously. He wants to be able to negotiate with Hillary, and I think he's playing hard to get. But he will come into the fold. I think that meeting with the president was the beginning of that process, and you could hear the conciliation in his voice immediately after that meeting. So once he and Hillary meet, I think you'll begin to see Bernie supporters coming into the fold.
Well, and it feels as if Donald Trump has been just a little bit quiet for Donald Trump. We know that he's going to be giving a speech on Monday. Of course, he'll be attacking Clinton, who's now been endorsed by President Obama. Rebecca, what can we expect to hear? What kind of Trump do you think we're going to hear? We may hear from him sooner. Something may happen. But what do you think we'll hear?
Well, this is the question. And there are a lot of Republicans who would love to know exactly which Donald Trump is going to show up on any given day. You know, on Tuesday, there was a rough day after his comments on Monday, and they spent the day kind of regrouping and coming together. He was quiet. He was off Twitter for more than 20 hours, which, of course, for him is very unusual.
Well, and you had Hillary Clinton calling for him to delete his Twitter, to get rid of his Twitter.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the interesting thing about that was, of course, her tweet back at him was retweeted far more than his original, and he didn't respond for several hours. Why? Because he was behind closed doors with Republican donors and the GOP establishment, speaking to them, looking to reassure them. And that's what this week has been about, not just what we've heard from Donald Trump, teleprompter Trump, you know, the one who's giving a more subdued performance that earns the RNC chair's praise, but also what's happening behind closed doors that we can't see.
Well, and here's something that we could see. Was Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, on ABC's Good Morning America, condemning Trump's comments on the judge yesterday. Here he is.
This is something that needed to be condemned. That comment is beyond the pale. That's not political correctness. Suggesting that a person can't do their job because of their race or ethnicity, that's not a politically incorrect thing to do. That's just a wrong thing to say.
And here was Trump, who didn't specifically refer to this controversy on primary night, but he did say this.
My goal is always, again, to bring people together. But if I'm forced to fight for something I really care about, I will never, ever back down. And our country will never, ever back down.
Greg, as we mentioned, Mark Kirk, the senator from Illinois, had unendorsed Trump this week because of all of this. Do you expect more of that? Or is this going to be another one of these controversies that seems bigger than it really is for Trump?
Oh, no. I think it's a serious controversy. And he's forcing Republicans to twist themselves into pretzels. I mean, it was really hard to watch Ryan trying to defend a racist comment and then say, but in the end,
Donald Trump is better than
Hillary. I'll back this guy before I back Hillary. So I think Trump needs to be careful. You know, a couple of more of these, and he might lose someone like Ryan. But at the moment, I think they're trying as best they can to present a unified front. The one other thing I would just add is I think Hillary needs to be careful and not trying to out-Trump Trump.
Right.
She ought to lay off Twitter.
Well, enter Warren. To do that for her, right.
Let her do that.
Right. Hey, Greg Moore, while we have you, former editor of the Denver Post, terrific newsman, but also longtime sports lover.
Yeah.
We just have to ask you, Muhammad Ali's being buried, eulogized, celebrated today.
Yeah.
There is a story that floats around about a young Greg Moore at Boston Globe who had a life-size or bigger than life-size cutout of Muhammad Ali
That's
always
true.
In his office, and one day he signed it.
Yeah. So Ali was at an event, and we were standing in a very long line, and a colleague said, you know, if you had any guts, you go get your cutout and bring it and have Ali sign it. I had someone bring it down, and Ali was, you know, scribbling very slowly, looked over to his right, and I had the cutout, and he just looked up at me and said, I was a bad man, and he signed it. So, yeah, it was great.
As an African-American, this day, in the few seconds we have, it means what to you?
Say what? This day?
This day means what to you? Just your thoughts on this day.
You know, I'll always be grateful to Muhammad Ali for, imbuing me with great pride as an African-American and, you know, igniting my black consciousness. He made me understand that if you're really, really good at what you do, lots of doors will open for you. He was really an amazing inspiration.
Greg Moore, former editor of the Denver Post. Rebecca Cinderbrand with us as well, politics news editor for the Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
I was in L.A. earlier this week for the primary in California, and I took a quick trip up the coast to Malibu. California has some 840 miles of coastline, the third most in the U.S., and Malibu is among its most iconic stretches. To my right was a beach with wide sandy shores and surfable waves. To my left were homes built right up to the water, one of the many challenges facing California's beaches. I met Maggie Hall on the beach. She's trying to find solutions for those challenges as an attorney at the Environmental Defense Center.
Honestly, California's beaches are faced with a variety of human-caused threats. We risk the next oil spill that could come onto our shores. We risk the continued development of our coastlines, eliminating our beaches. And we risk pollution from sources like stormwater.
And have things gotten better or worse on those fronts over the last couple of decades?
Unfortunately, they've gotten worse, and the threats are only increased.
So, for example, when we talk about oil and gas, tell me what you're talking about. How serious is the threat?
Oil and gas has long been an incredible threat to our coastline. We saw that most vividly in 1969 with the Santa Barbara oil spill, which in large part gave rise to the modern environmental movement. And unfortunately, we saw another devastating example of that just over a year ago in Santa Barbara again, when the Plains All-American pipeline ruptured and spewed over 140,000 gallons of crude oil off the coast and into our marine environment.
How much oil production is going on off the coast of California?
There are currently 22 federal platforms offshore California in the Pacific. 19 of those platforms are in the Santa Barbara Channel, and they're currently operating. And recently we've seen increased practices of fracking and acidizing occurring right out in the ocean.
And this is being done legally?
In our opinion, it's illegal. However, the federal government is authorizing it. So the battle continues.
But as we stand here on the beach in Malibu and see these people having a nice time surfing, walking along the beach, does this affect them at all?
Certainly. Beaches were closed right after the oil spill at Refugio. The Refugio oil spill, even though it occurred onshore from a pipeline, damaged 150 miles of California coastline. It closed fisheries. It killed countless numbers of marine wildlife, including dolphins, seabirds, and more. And it made it unsafe for human recreation.
Is the water clean?
After a storm event, especially not. Beaches close annually because of storm events in California. That's because of all of the industrial pollution that's throughout our watershed that's carried down to the beaches and into the ocean.
What about the issue of erosion? How much has that affected the beaches?
Well, in California, we've actually lost over 90% of our coastal wetlands. So we've lost a lot of our natural buffers to things like sea level rise. And continued development on our coastline is only adding to problems of erosion. We've seen efforts at beach armoring, such as rock revetments and seawalls, and those have only caused the massive loss of beaches.
Well, as we stand here, as people know, if they've been to the Los Angeles area, there are big hills right next to the beach. So it doesn't feel in the same way that, you know, Miami Beach feels so susceptible to sea level rise. But of course, in other parts of California, that's not the case.
The problem is in California, we've developed right up to our beaches. And so we sort of don't have a natural buffer anymore that would protect us from sources like sea level rise. And going forward, we need to start planning and taking that into account.
Well, tell me more about that. Are there regulations that stop people from building right up to the beaches, or should there be more regulations on that score?
In California, we actually have an incredibly strong law called the Coastal Act that authorized the California Coastal Commission, which has really strong protections for the environment and public access to beaches. And right now, the California Coastal Commission has put out a guidance to help plan for sea level rise, to help cities and counties moving forward take into account sea level rise with their long-term planning. So hopefully we'll start to see smart long-term decisions moving forward that account for sea level rise. But unfortunately, there have been, you know, mistakes in the past and overdevelopment in the past, and it's really hard to mitigate for certain ecological losses that we've already suffered.
When you talk about mistakes and overdevelopment in the past, as we look down the beach here, those houses are actually over the water. Is that what you're talking about?
That's right. And you'll see right next to that, there's a rock revetment. And in front of that rock revetment, there's no sand. And that's because the beach has been entirely eroded. Whereas if you look to our other direction, there's an entirely sandy beach where you don't see that same kind of beach armoring. And in fact, there's been restoration efforts made in that area to restore the lagoon, which serves similar functions to a wetland in terms of providing the same kind of habitat.
But how is it possible that such an environmentally conscious state like California is allowing this to happen to its beaches?
You know, California does get a reputation for being environmental and ahead of the times in terms of our climate change efforts. But unfortunately, we do have quite a few environmental resources that are constantly, under the eye of oil industry and development. It's a fabulous place to live, and we have all of these incredible natural resources that make it that way. But those are at risk of extraction and risk of development.
What do you think this state's beaches are going to look like in 50 years if things keep going the way that they're going?
Well, if things keep going the way they're going, we're going to see more oil spills. We're going to see oil trains. We're going to see no beaches if we keep building seawalls. We're going to lose what California is known for, which is, you know, incredible beach towns, incredible environment, recreation. All of those resources are at risk, and we need to protect them.
And is that protection something that can be done by at the state level, or is it going to require federal intervention?
It's coming from all levels. So a lot of times you'll have a local project that will have statewide implications, like the crude by rail project at Phillips 66, or you'll have a federal project that will have local implications, like offshore fracking and acidizing. Those are under federal offshore platforms, and yet the consequences will be felt by local communities.
Well, Maggie Hall, a staff attorney at the Environmental Defense Center, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's take up the news today that the U.S. is expanding the military mission in Afghanistan. President Obama has given U.S. commanders new authority to target the Taliban and increase the support the U.S. provides to regular Afghan infantry forces, in addition to the special forces they already assist. This expanded authority comes as Afghan forces are struggling to beat back a resurgent Taliban, especially in southern Afghanistan. Phil Ewing is NPR's national security correspondent. He joins us from Washington. And first of all, Phil, just remind us where we are. What had been allowed? Defensive airstrikes.
Well, before now, U.S. troops had been able to do basically three things: defend themselves, go after so-called terrorist groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, their remnants in Afghanistan, and defend the Afghans from major defeats, situations in which a big overrun would represent a strategic loss. Now, the president's authority adds kind of a fourth category to the airstrikes that U.S. commanders can use, which is to enable Afghans in the attack, if they're on an offensive, to succeed if doing so will make a difference. Yeah. The Pentagon says that does not mean there'll be American airstrikes for every Afghan operation, but where they can be more effective, they will now be allowed.
Well, and some reports on this are saying this still does not mean that troops will be involved in direct combat. Is that the Pentagon saying that, or, you know, an interpretation by reporters? And if you have to have troops on the ground to call in strikes, doesn't that mean that troops will be in combat?
Well, to you and me and many of our listeners in the country, yes, it absolutely means that. But the politics of this are very difficult for the White House and President Obama, because he made a very big announcement a few years ago about how the combat mission in Iraq and Afghanistan was over and the American forces who remained there would be only in a support role. In reality, American forces have been in direct firefights with hostile forces mm-hmm. in both places and killed in both places by enemy action since then. And so it's politically difficult for the White House to acknowledge what's really taking place, although Defense Secretary Ash Carter, Joint Chiefs Chairman General Doug Dunford, and other people at that level at the Pentagon have basically come around and said, yes, we are putting these Afghan and American troops into combat situations, and those who are being hurt or killed are clearly being done so, you know, in direct action.
Yeah, there's been one U.S. combat death in Afghanistan this year, and of course, the war hit home to NPR. Photojournalist Dave Gilkey and his Afghan interpreter, Zabiullah Tamana, killed when the Taliban attacked the convoy they were riding in. So very much, you know, blurred line between the front lines and combat. But the conflict has been going on with U.S. troops assisting and training Afghan forces since 2001. What's the problem?
The problem, in short, is that the U.S. has created a force that Afghanistan cannot sustain and be as effective as American troops can. The Afghan government can't afford it. It can't function logistically in the background the way the U.S. military can. And so every year after the so-called fighting season, whatever gains the Afghans have made, they cannot reinforce the next year during the next fighting season, which is why as spring and summer begin in Afghanistan, the Taliban are making these gains and making these new attempts to pressure the Afghans, and the U.S. has to respond with these expanded authorities. This has happened before, and it will probably happen again just because you know, the Afghans so far are not strong enough and cannot act effectively enough to win this conflict decisively.
Yeah. And we talked about putting troops in harm's way, but also civilians. More airstrikes might mean more mistakes, tragic mistakes. The U.S. airstrike that killed more than 3 dozen people at a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz.
That's right. There's always a risk every time you use air power in these very complex battlefield situations. And there's been some reporting since then by the New York Times Magazine that suggested the Afghan troops on the ground who were helping coordinate that battle may have deliberately targeted the hospital. That's not definitive. We don't know that for certain, according to official sources. But clearly the situation is complicated. It's muddy. It's fluid. And this just makes things even more dynamic when you're flying warplanes around, dropping ordnance on people on the ground.
It's all those things, and it's expanding. Phil Ewing, NPR's National Security Editor, thank you.
Thank you.
As boxing great Muhammad Ali is laid to rest today, we've learned of the death of another sports legend. Canadian hockey great Gordie Howe died today at the age of 88. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau remembered Howe today.
He was a gentleman, but he was also very much a tough guy. Showcased the best of what Canadians like to think of ourselves as. Highlighted both our national sport and our national identity on an international stage.
Howe played in more National Hockey League All-Star games than any other player in history, 23, and famously played right wing with the Detroit Red Wings. And he remains Mr. Hockey to a generation of fans. Steve Carmody from Here and Now contributor Michigan Radio has this remembrance.
Gordie Howe played hockey with an intensity he learned as a boy in Saskatoon during the Depression. In his 2014 autobiography, Howe wrote about playing for his school team, not on the right wing where generations of hockey fans were used to seeing him, but as a goalie. Howe credited his time in the net for making him ambidextrous. The ability to shoot equally well from the left and the right made Gordie Howe one of the greatest scorers in the history of the National Hockey League. By 1946, 18-year-old Gordie Howe was playing for the Detroit Red Wings. During the next quarter century, Howe's ability to score and his willingness to fight led to 4 Stanley Cup trophies, 6 National Hockey League scoring titles, and being named the league's most valuable player a half dozen times. Gordie Howe also racked up more than 2,000 minutes in the penalty box. In an interview for the Biography Channel, Howe talked about how he used his physical strength to intimidate other players on the ice.
If you learn to play a little rough and shade the rules a little bit, sometimes you get a little more respect. And respect gives you more room. And you get a little more room to maneuver, then you're going to be a better hockey player.
The hockey life did leave its scars. Broken bones, hundreds of stitches. The game took a physical toll on Gordie Howe. By his own count, his nose was broken 14 times. In the 1950 playoffs, he suffered a skull fracture that almost killed him. Gordie Howe retired in 1971 and was elected to the Hall of Fame in 1972. But by 1973, Gordie Howe was back on the ice. An offer to play alongside his sons in the fledgling World Hockey Association lured Gordie Howe out of retirement, and the legend held his own, skating against men half his age. Gordie Howe didn't hang up his skates for good until 1980, when he was 52 years old. Howe still holds several NHL records, including most seasons played, most regular season games played, and most seasons with 20 or more goals. He's also the only man to play in the NHL in five different decades. He even played in one minor league hockey game when he was 70. In 1998, the Hockey News ranked Gordie Howe as the third best player in history, though many on that list say Gordie Howe was the best of all time. Michigan radio sports commentator John U. Bacon says Gordie Howe is the greatest sports icon in Michigan history.
In hockey, he's Babe Ruth. Yes, Babe Ruth's records have been surpassed, and so have Gordie Howe's by Wayne Gretzky in his case. But he was truly, and it's trademarked, Mr. Hockey. And no one else in the state of Michigan can come close to that icon status.
In his autobiography, Howe wrote that when he was asked why he played so long, he would reply, he never stopped loving the game. Many years after he stopped playing, his fans never stopped loving him. For Here and Now, I'm Steve Carmody.
Tuesday night, more than 6.5 million people tuned in to The Bachelorette on ABC. It was the second most watched show on TV that night. Here's a clip of Daniel talking to the show's villain this year, Chad.
You know, let's just pretend you're Hitler. If I'm friends with you...
Let's not pretend I'm Hitler.
Well, let's just say it. Let's just say it, you know.
Let's not say that.
Okay, well, let's say you're Donald Trump or something like that. I mean, if I hang out with you... It's going to make me look bad, too, right? So let's, like, be not so much like Hitler, maybe be more like Mussolini, you know?
Joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
Well, I have to say, I've never seen the show, and now I think it's completely different than what I thought it was. But tell me, why do people love this show so much?
Oh, man. Well, you know, for me, that's the $10 million question because I think it's terrible. But basically, both of these shows, The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, have presented this sort of princess fantasy for viewers that plays out like a soap opera. And the themes are, you know, finding true love and, you know, all of this in a very contrived, very manipulated process where that contrivance and that manipulation is hidden from viewers. And that's the problem that I have with the show, is that viewers can't trust a single second of what they're seeing. And so you're constantly watching this and getting the sense that these are sort of chess pieces that producers are aiming at each other to create telegenic TV moments that aren't necessarily any kind of depiction of anything that's actually happening in these people's lives. And so add to that the fact that it sort of reinforces these retrograde ideas about what romance is and what makes a woman desirable and what makes a man desirable.
Well, what about the gender roles that are pushed on these shows?
Well, one of the things that bugs me and other critics who've written about this show, for example, is where does a woman's value come from on this show? Does it come from her intelligence? Does it come from her achievements in, you know, whatever she chooses to do, her job or her life? Or does it come from the fact that she's attractive? There's a double standard, I feel, about sexual activity on these shows, where the male bachelor on The Bachelor show can make out with, and even you get the sense that maybe he's had sexual contact with a lot of the women and he doesn't pay a price. But there's a different set of standards applied to the woman when she's the bachelorette choosing amongst the men. Even the fact that she kisses and makes out with a lot of the men can sometimes draw criticism, which is a weird place to be in a show where the idea is to ostensibly sample these suitors and figure out which one she wants to be with, quote-unquote, for the rest of her life.
Well, I hate to pile on, Eric, but I did notice that in 32 seasons of The Bachelor or Bachelorette franchise, there hasn't been a main contestant who was black.
Yeah, and that's another reason. You know, it highlights another blind spot of the show, which is it's a very white show, and even the contestants of color or the non-white contestants who appear on the show, you know, they have had a Hispanic bachelor. They've had a few Hispanic women who have been chosen by bachelors, but dark-skinned people don't tend to advance very far on that show. They've never had a black bachelor or bachelorette. And I think there's a vision of the show that is very deliberate and very focused and very contrived, and it does not often include people who have dark skin. And I think that's bizarre. And I think it's bizarre that fans of the show aren't troubled by that more, because it is suggesting that this fairy tale romance that the show is striving for and depicting is only accessible to certain kinds of people. And that ultimately is a terrible message for a show to send.
Eric, you were talking earlier about all of the behind-the-scenes stuff that the producers of these shows do to create the what we see on screen, and maybe that's not exactly what reality is. It brings me to another show that came back this week in its second season called Unreal. Now, this is a scripted show, but it's kind of about the production of these Bachelorette-type shows. I enjoyed the first season of this show. What did you think of this season, or what do we have coming up?
Well, I've seen the first two episodes of the new season. I think it's great. They start out with the show choosing a black suitor, is what they call their bachelor, a sports star who has controversies in his past, will be choosing amongst a bevy of women to find his true love. And they deal with all of the craziness and conflict and weirdness about race that you would expect to happen if they'd done that in real life. And in a weird way, it gives you a sense about why ABC is probably too skittish about actually doing it in real life, because there's a lot of questions about, you know, who would he pick? And if he's a black man who is focusing on white women, will that even turn off black viewers? And if he's a black man who's rejecting white women and focusing on black women, would that turn off white viewers? And can white viewers, who are the majority of the people watching the show, identify with this guy? And this show sort of dramatizes all of these backstage conversations that you think would happen with producers and would happen with talent, to try and manipulate them into producing the kind of stuff that we see on these shows. So I love it. I think it does a great job of highlighting the hypocrisies and the conflicts that come when you try to manipulate and contrive this sort of weird romantic situation on television.
So in other words, if you want to watch reality TV, probably more fun to watch a show that's not even pretending to be real about reality TV.
Exactly.
Well, Eric, one more thing I got to ask you about before we let you go. New show about O.J. Simpson, another one, documentary airing this weekend on ABC. Is it good?
Now, I know people think they've gotten their fill of O.J. Simpson, especially if you watched FX's American Crime Story, but this is a really, really good documentary. It's part of ESPN's 30 for 30 series. It's a five-part. They really examine O.J. Simpson as a cultural icon and what his arc means for all of us. It's a really, really well-done thing, and they come up with some revelations that even people who watched the FX series would not know about and would find surprising. So I would say it's well worth the time, and it debuts on Saturday and runs through the rest of next week. It's going to be an amazing 30 for 30 documentary. It might be one of the best ones they've ever done.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks.
Always a pleasure.
We want to note an anniversary. Tomorrow marks 30 years since one of my favorite movies was released in theaters.
Incredible. One of the worst performances of my career, and they never doubted it for a second. How could I possibly be expected to handle school on a day like this?
Ferris Bueller's Day Off, released June 11th, 1986. I was three. And no, I didn't see it in theaters, but I did see it somewhere around age 10 and at least 100 times since then. Now, if you are unlucky enough to have never seen it, it is a John Hughes film about a high school student in suburban Chicago, played by Matthew Broderick, who lies to his parents so he can take a day off from school, then gets his friends to take the day off too, in part by prank calling the school principal, played by Jeffrey Jones, who thinks he's on to the prank.
Well, it's been a tough morning, and we've got a lot of family business to take care of, so if you wouldn't mind excusing Sloan, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, Neil, I'd be happy to. Yeah, you just produce a corpse, and I'll release Sloan. I want to see this dead grandmother firsthand.
At this point, I can pretty much quote the entire film, but nothing beats this scene when the school secretary, played by Edie McClurg, tries to get the principal to understand Ferris Bueller.
Oh, well, he's very popular, Ed. The sportos, the motorheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies. They all adore him. They think he's a righteous dude.
There are countless cameos, including the one that launched Ben Stein's Hollywood career.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the, the Great Depression, passed the, a tariff bill.
the Hawley Smoot tariff bill, which anyone raised or lowered, raised tariffs in an effort to create more revenue for the federal government. So, 30 years since Ferris Bueller's Day Off. By the way, we tried to get an actor from the movie on the show, even stood in their driveway in L.A. earlier this week for our planned interview, but I guess they decided to take the day off.
Garbage is piling up. There are fuel shortages. Trains aren't running on time. France is witnessing a wave of strikes to protest that new labor reform law. Strikes that have disrupted just about every aspect of life. Oh, and it's flooding from heavy rains. And this is as one of the biggest soccer tournaments in the world begins in France today. And the real concern is even scarier, terrorism. French President François Hollande has acknowledged the real possibility of an attack during the tournament. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
90,000 personnes qui vont être affectées à la sécurité.
90,000 security officers will keep control in the stadium and the fan zones. The spectators will have a body search so that there won't be any risk of weapons entering.
During the terrorist attacks in Paris last November that killed 130 people, three suicide bombers set off their devices outside one of the stadiums where some of the matches in this tournament will now be played. No one was killed inside that stadium, but obviously nerves are on edge. BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera joins us from London. And Gordon, President Hollande talked about 90,000 police and security officials. What else is going on?
That's right, 90,000 police and security officials, very visible police and military presence in France. They've even put out a phone app to people, so which will give them instructions on what to do in the event of a terrorist attack, telling them that one's happening in their region, if depending on geolocating where they are, and giving them instructions on how to respond, all done in a way so that if their phone is silent, it won't vibrate and draw attention to themselves. So you can see from all of those things just how nervy France is. I think it's trying to be realistic about it, but it's certainly a pretty grim mood with which to start a football tournament, especially with all those other things you were talking about happening as well, not least the weather.
Well, and do we understand, there's one little detail we didn't understand. Bars and restaurants are banned from setting up TV outside the establishments. Why is that?
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the concerns that's been raised by British and other officials and the French themselves is that actually it's not just the venues where the games are taking place which could be a target. But if you think back to those attacks in November in Paris, which killed so many people, they were targeting restaurants and cafes then. And the fear is you will get large congregations of people gathering either in what are called special zones to watch the football games or at cafes and bars to watch it, with them spilling out to the streets, gathering in large crowds, and that could present a very soft target. Mm. And so while those troops that we heard about and the police and security officials, you can deploy those to the stadiums, much harder to do that to all the cafes and restaurants where people might gather around Paris and other cities. And so for that reason, they are issuing that kind of advice to try and restrict the danger from an attack on those kind of targets.
Well, this week there was an arrest of a Frenchman who authorities said was plotting an attack during the tournament. Did they say more? Was he planning to go to a stadium?
That's a really curious case. So this happened in Ukraine, and the Ukrainian authorities say they detained a 25-year-old Frenchman with a huge arsenal of weapons and explosives, which he was planning, it said, to drive to France and carry out an attack. What's interesting about that was all been prepared really for the idea of perhaps an ISIS, a so-called Islamic State style attack on the games and on France. This was actually a Frenchman, an ultra right-wing nationalist, who apparently was unhappy about immigration and about Islamization of France, as he put it, who was planning on attacking during the games, perhaps French government offices plus mosques and synagogues, but not necessarily, it's thought, the games themselves. But that gives you the idea that these games can become a target for all kinds of people with agendas, not just a group like ISIS or ISIL, as we think of as being the main problem.
Just just underscore what you just said. This was not an Islamist. This was, a fundamentalist,
a far right wing nationalist, French nationalist, who disliked the direction his country was heading and thought that the European Football Championships would be a good time to carry out an attack. And we have seen far right attacks in Europe, of course, Anders Breivik in Norway, who killed very many people. So, you know, the threat environment even is pretty complex. But still, I think the main concern is from ISIS or ISIL.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be tough because the matches are across the country, 10 different cities, millions of people attending. Is Olan, it sounds like he's saying we can't.
I think what he's saying is we're doing everything we can, but we have to be realistic about the threat. And I think, you know, that's what's been interesting about the tone from the French, I think, is to say people need to be prepared. They need to be prepared that there is a threat, that something could happen. But nevertheless, we're not going to let it stop us carrying on with these football championships. So I think the tone has been quite interesting and quite kind of grim in some ways, but I think everyone is just hoping that once the games get going, people will be able to focus on the sport and not on the terror threat.
Well, grim, but also in some ways, you know, very chin up, you know,
realistic, I suppose,
and undefeated. Gordon Carrera, the BBC security correspondent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.